her deepness, which was the New Yorker called her. So with that, her deepness, it is my pleasure.
Well, this is a great pleasure to be here in the mountains where there used to be an ocean once upon a time. Never forget that. So I'm here to really celebrate the blue part of the planet. It's a part of the world that is really fundamentally the most important for life. Without the ocean, without water, there is no life. Without the blue, there's no green. Think about it. A lot of people are thinking green these days, but unless you take the water into consideration, then you're really missing the big blue point. The voice of the ocean has been neglected, perhaps because the fish don't vote, because the decisions that are being made about most of life on Earth, that's the ocean. Most of life on Earth is in the ocean. It's 97% of the biosphere. It's where the greatest diversity of life is, and but it's not at the table, except on the table, cooked, you know, steamed, fried, various ways of presenting life in the ocean when it's dead. But the voice of the reality of the living ocean has been seriously neglected. But it's time, past time, but there's no time like the present to try to catch up and do everything we can in the time that we have to really put the light on the aquatic part of the Earth. So that's really what I'm going to focus on today. 3 years ago, I attended a conference in Spain. I had a chance to meet the man who is the leader at Google for the phenomenon called Google Earth. He actually was head of a company called Keyhole. I discovered Keyhole before it was acquired by Google Earth. I paid my $600 so that I could hold the world in my hands and actually turn it around. That's what you can do today with Google Earth, but you can do it with its predecessor, but not quite as elegantly or as well populated with information as you can today. I mean, any little kid can do what not so long ago only big decision makers behind a cloak of secrecy could do when Keyhole existed in that way, before it became public and before then Google acquired it. So, conference in Spain. John and I were, John Hanke, head of Google Earth, and I were among the speakers, and I got to go first. And I had a chance, among other things. Of course, I was talking about the ocean. He was going to talk about Google Earth. But I said how much I love Google Earth, because for the first time you can see that the world is mostly blue. I mean, anybody could see that with a globe. But it just popped out. I didn't intend to say this, but it just flashed in my brain, and one of those things that changes your life forever. I said, John, I hope someday you'll finish it. Right now you've done a great job with Google Earth, but you should call it Google Dirt, because you've forgotten the ocean. I mean, the ocean is there, but just the surface. What's under the surface is what really counts. The greatest mountains, the greatest valleys, the broadest plains, but most importantly, that's where most of life on Earth actually is. And I love going to see my backyard, my neighbor's backyard. The kids can fly through the Grand Canyon. We can find Starbucks on Google Earth. But what about the ocean? Now, he could have been offended, but to his credit, instead of going off in a huff, John Hanke invited me to come down to the Googleplex to meet with the Googlers and to see what we could do to put the ocean in Google Earth. It has taken 3 years, but in February of this year, 2009, you can download, anybody can, any little kid can, any big decision maker can, any head of corporation, anybody can go to Google Earth, download 5.0. You can go to Mars, and you can also go to the bottom of the ocean. The first question was, okay, what's missing? Well, first of all, you couldn't see that there are mountains out there, valleys. You couldn't see the configuration of the seafloor, and there's a good reason for that. Only 5% of the ocean has really been mapped. We know a lot more about the moon, about Mars, about the surface of Jupiter, than we do about the surface of our own planet, if you consider not the water surface, but the configuration of the rocks and sand, what we think of as the land. There's a lot of land under the ocean, but it's so hard to visualize it with the technologies that we have today. You can't fly over the ocean and see the bottom of it. Well, you can using sound. That's what dolphins and whales do. They use their own built-in sonar. And for the last half century, we've gotten a lot better with our own technologies of seeing with sound, but a very small amount of the ocean has been mapped with anything like the detail that we have for this planet on the land, or moon, or the moon, or Mars, or the other places in the universe. So we have really tried to map. So thanks to the technologies that enable us to look at the world from high in the sky, we can now get the broad patterns of where the mountains and valleys are, looking at the slight difference there is in sea level. The satellite measurements from hundreds of miles away, you can actually detect minor but important elevation changes in the seafloor below based on the elevation changes that are reflected on the surface above. It's kind of amazing that we can do that, but it is possible, and it is now, through this technology, possible to discover where there are a great many mountains in the sea that we didn't know about before we could use satellites to detect the nature of the seafloor below. And that's what you'll see if you go to the new Atlas of the Ocean. I had a chance during the same 3-year period to work with the National Geographic with my co-author and geologist friend, Linda Glover, side by side with the Geographic looking and the Navy looking at the latest and greatest seafloor maps. What you see now on Google Earth, Google Ocean, if you will, is the best publicly available downloadable version of the seafloor configuration. Better information exists, but it's still behind locked doors in various military establishments, and someday maybe it'll become as available as information about the surface. So what I've brought with me today are some clips that anybody can go see. The audience listening can do this. Go to Google Earth 5.0, go to the ocean, and find the Explore the Ocean layer, and check out places that I'm going to discuss now. There are actually about a dozen places that we called feature areas. The National Geographic and Google teamed up to put these beautiful places. This is part of the vision I had when I first talked to John Hanke. I said, imagine being able to fly over the planet and see little blue spots that you touch on them, and then you can dive in. You can see what's there. You can go visit with the fish and the whales. You can see what they see. Well, basically, that's what I want to share with you, whether it's just hearing the sounds or imagine seeing what I'm about to share with you. We did an overview piece that describes some of the state of the world. We can start with that. And it's narrated by me and the fish and the whales. And then we'll take it from there. If we could go to that first little piece.
From afar, the world is blue, with an all-encompassing ocean, the source of all life. Without the ocean, Earth would be as bleak, as barren, as Mars or the moon. With every drop of water you drink, every breath you take, you're connected to the sea, no matter where on Earth you live. Life in the sea generates about 70% of the oxygen in the atmosphere. It absorbs much of the carbon dioxide. The ocean drives climate and weather, regulates and stabilizes temperature, shapes Earth's chemistry. Water evaporates from the surface of the sea, forms clouds that return water to land and sea as rain, sleet, and snow. The ocean covers nearly three-quarters of the Earth's surface, but that's just the surface. The average depth is 4 kilometers, the maximum 11 kilometers, 7 miles down. Ninety-seven percent of Earth's water is ocean. It should be no surprise that 97% of Earth's living space is ocean space. The greatest abundance and diversity of life is there, with forms that represent nearly all of the major categories of plants, animals, and microbes that exist on Earth. Life abounds even at the greatest depth, where the pressure is more than 1,000 times greater than at the surface. Diving into the sea is like diving into the history of life on Earth, where creatures precede humankind by hundreds of millions of years. It's a vast liquid realm where diaphanous creatures thrive: jellies, squids, silvery fish. Creatures that illuminate the deep sea darkness with their own living light. The terrain below holds most of the world's mountains, entire chains of peaks that run down the major ocean basins like giant backbones. Most of the planet's volcanoes are in the sea, many forming the underpinnings of islands such as Hawaii, the Galapagos, Iceland, and thousands of others. With new technologies, submarines, ships, satellites, we've discovered more about the ocean in the past half century than during all preceding history. Yet most of the ocean, about 95%, has yet to be seen by human eyes, let alone explored. Far into the 20th century, people thought that the sea was infinite in its capacity to yield whatever we wanted to take from it and accept whatever we disposed of there. Over the years, hundreds of millions of tons of ocean wildlife have been extracted, and hundreds of millions of tons of noxious waste have been put into the sea. Industrial fishing has depleted fish and other ocean wildlife, some nearly to extinction. Many large and even small species of creatures have declined by more than 90% in half a century. Trawls and nets scrape the seafloor to catch shrimp and bottom-dwelling fish, scallops, and oysters. They're the equivalent of using bulldozers to catch songbirds and squirrels. Pollutants from agriculture, industrial waste, and sewage have seeped into the ocean, accumulating in marine organisms, even in the icy waters of the Arctic and the Antarctic. More than 300 dead zones now darken coastal areas worldwide. Plastic debris is dumped in such quantities that a huge floating mass of garbage twice the size of Texas has formed in the Pacific, and plastic clogs the shores of even remote Pacific islands. The construction of coastal cities has brought about the loss of coral reefs, mangrove forests, and vast wetlands, and the birds and marine life that once thrived there. Recent changes in the ocean are compounding the impacts of global warming. And in turn, climate change, increasing sea level, and acidification are altering the nature of the ocean. Now we know. One of the great discoveries of our time is that there are limits to what we can take out and what we can put in without dire consequences to the nature of the ocean, and thus to the underpinnings of what makes life possible for us. Now that we know, we can do what it takes to reverse the troubling trends, to treat the ocean as if our lives depend on it. Because they do.
And that's the point. Our lives depend on the ocean. So why aren't we taking better care of it? I think it starts with simply not knowing. We are terrestrial by nature. Some people in this group, I think, do have gills. One is sitting right up here in the front row, who's been diving for as long as I have, starting in 1952. The world was a little bluer then, perhaps. There were more fish, fewer people. I tell people sometimes that I come from a different planet, because the planet I came from was a very different one from what we now know. And part of the problem is expressed in a little poem that I'd like to read to you, if I may. It's by one of my favorite authors, Don Marquis. He wrote Archie and Mehitable. If you haven't read Archie and Mehitable, please haul it out of some dark corner of a library or whatever, download it, and read about Warty Bliggins the toad. The poem goes like this. I met a toad the other day by the name of Warty Bliggins. He was sitting under a toadstool feeling contented. He explained that when the cosmos was created, that toadstool was especially planned for his personal shelter from sun and rain, thought out and prepared for him. "Do not tell me," said Warty Bliggins, "that there is not a purpose in the universe. The thought is blasphemy." A little more conversation revealed that Warty Bliggins considers himself to be the center of the same universe. The earth exists to grow toadstools for him to sit under, the sun to give him light by day, and the moon and wheeling constellations to make beautiful the night for the sake of Warty Bliggins. "To what act of yours do you impute this interest on the part of the creator of the universe?" I asked him. "Why is it that you are so greatly favored?" "Ask rather," said Warty Bliggins, "what the universe has done to deserve me. If I were a human being, I would not laugh too complacently at poor Warty Bliggins, for similar absurdities have only too frequently lodged in the crinkles of the human cerebrum." There we are. We think it's all about us. Think of this, as Carl Sagan would have us think, that the universe began, as we now believe anyway, about 11 billion years ago, maybe 14 billion, a billion here, a billion there, whatever. About 4.5 billion years ago is the starting point for this planet. The oceans have been around most of that time. Life formed not too far after the arrival of water, 3.5, 4 billion years ago, entirely microbial. Little guys ruled. They still do, oh, by the way, but that's all there was for a very, very long time. Carl Sagan suggests that you squeeze that entire history of the universe into a single year and then figure out where we fit in the greater scheme of things. Think of this, Warty Bliggins, that for most of the time, there was no life in the history of the universe, and when there was, when Earth came along with its water and with microbes, microbes ruled until sometime about in the middle of December. Human beings our history. Take it back as far as you like. It's just in that last little sliver of time on the last day of December. I mean, we're sitting here in the last little tiniest piece of the last second of the last hour of the last day of that year. And we think it's all about us. We have somehow come to the conclusion that the table has been set and it's our job to just be gluttons to take from whatever is here, for not just for humankind, but for our little piece of human history. We've been burning through the assets that have accumulated in terms of the petrochemicals that have formed over literally hundreds of millions of years, all in the month of December, of course, but nonetheless, we, in just the last sliver of that last hour, last minute of December, have burned through the assets that took millions of years to form. Forests and in the ocean, the microbes that accumulated in the bottom of the sea and compressed over time to form the oil and gas deposits that we're drawing down. Now, there is a lot more out there. In the bottom of the sea, there are petrochemicals known as gas hydrates that probably exceed all the other oil and gas reserves put together. They're held in place loosely by a formation, a lattice-like formation of methane and water in deep water, 2,000 feet or so. I've seen some, actually, seen gas bubbles coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, driving a little submersible out there, and seeing these little bubbles that become big bubbles when the pressure is released as they get to the surface. Methane is even more worrisome than carbon dioxide, more powerful, a greenhouse gas, but it doesn't last as long, decades, not centuries. So it dissipates faster, but it's still a matter of concern when you look at the balance sheet for what's happening to cause global warming now, all because of us, all because of the Warty Bliggins approach to living, that we think that it is just about this little brief piece that we occupy that's burned through the assets and make whatever it is bright and beautiful for our little sliver of time, but forget about the past and certainly forget about the future. Well, the concerns were expressed by Woody Allen 30 years ago in a speech that he made to the graduates, 1979. It was published in the New York Times. He said, "More than at any other time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness. The other, to total extinction." Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly. I'd like to propose that there really is a third pathway. There is cause for hope. And I think we live at a time when, for the very first time, we understand what our predecessors did not. In a way, I can forgive those long ago predecessors of ours who did in the last dodo, the last great auk, killed off the large mammals that once occupied the space we're sitting here in Aspen. There once, imagine the big elephants, the camels, the horses that once were here in North America 10,000 years ago. They're gone. It is thought that we had a hand in that, our ancestors did. We didn't know that there were limits to what we could get away with. Now we know. Now, for the very first time in history, toward the end of the 20th century, and now sneaking into the 21st, we've got a perspective that is, I think, our best hope for getting it right, that we're a part of nature. We're not apart from it. Our lives depend on maintaining the integrity of the natural systems that give us oxygen, that give us a stable planet, that gives us a hope for the conditions that will ensure survival, not just for the rest of the critters that share space with us, but for us as a part of the system. Well, we began to suspect that there were connections that were really important in the early part of the 20th century, and so developed over the years a network, starting in this country, of national parks. Some say it's the best idea America ever had, partly because we value the landscapes, we value the beauty of places like Aspen, Colorado, and the areas that we have established as national parks, partly because they please us aesthetically, but increasingly we understand that they're important because they harbor some of the best reservoirs of biodiversity, which builds in resilience in times of change. We have a better chance of finding somebody in the mix that will respond favorably to changed temperature, to changed circumstances, whatever they might be. What we've neglected, though, is the ocean in all of this. It wasn't until 1972 that the first legislation came about in Australia and in the United States, more or less simultaneously, to protect the ocean with networks of protected areas, marine sanctuaries. In Australia, it's a Great Barrier Reef National Marine Park Authority. In the United States, it started with a tiny little piece in the Florida Keys that later became a somewhat larger piece. Now, in the United States, a network of about 14 protected areas, including a number that were established just in the past 3 years. 140,000 square miles of ocean around Hawaii, established 3 years ago, 2006, as a national monument. It's bigger than all of our national parks put together. And then in January of this past year, it was one of the last and maybe one of the best things that Bush did during his administration. A big chunk of the Pacific Ocean established as another huge marine protected area. Another 150,000 square miles of ocean where even the fish are safe. What a concept. But with all of that, it moved the scale from a fraction of 1%, actually about 0.6 of 1%, up to 0.8 of 1% of the ocean that has some form of protection. There are about 4,600 marine protected areas in the world today, starting from zero, going back to 1970. Now more than, it's edging up toward 5,000. But altogether, it's still less than 1% of the ocean. We have a lot of work to do. That means 99% of the ocean is up for grabs. It's being used, of course, by fishermen taking more than 150 million tons of carbon-based units out of the ocean every year, including the bycatch that is simply discarded. You know, we throw away so much of what is caught, and it's wildlife. Don't think of it as something we harvest from the sea. Don't think of it the way we think of cows and chickens and pigs, because we are taking top carnivores out of the ocean. We're not raising them. It's not even that we're helping the process along. We're undermining the capacity of the ocean to produce even what it's producing. And then, through the destructive approaches to fishing that we're using, we're undermining the capacity of the ocean to produce what it needs in order to continue being a prosperous place. I mean, we couldn't have done a better job to tear apart the systems upon which we are reliant for our survival had we been assigned the task. Go destroy the world! And we've done it through clear-cutting forests and clear-cutting the ocean using bottom trawlers that are indiscriminate about what they take. Giant swaths of the seafloor that are trawled time and time again. The wonder is that the ocean is still continuing to produce oxygen. 70% of the oxygen in the atmosphere comes from the sea. We think of the trees, and we should. They're really important, the green stuff, if you will. But the blue-green stuff, and the other green things as well in the ocean, does the heavy lifting when it comes to generating oxygen and grabbing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, making the planet what it is, our home, the only one we're likely ever to have, except for a few who might someday migrate to Mars or maybe even other places, but not anytime soon, and not enough to save the 7 billion of us who now occupy the Earth. I care. I care about me, of course, everybody does, with the warty bliggins little sliver that is inside of all of us. But I have 3 children. I have 4 grandsons. And I think about the world that we are passing along to them. And it's in that spirit that working with the National Geographic, working with Google, working with a little foundation that I started called Deep Search, I'm trying every way I know how to bring about support for protecting the ocean. Last January, at about the same time that Google Ocean launched in Google Earth, I was given a chance through TED to get a TED Prize and a TED Wish, and my wish was to protect the ocean, of course, through a network of what I call hope spots. Hope spots, places that if we can embrace them and protect them, hear this, Woody Allen, they give us hope. They really do. I hear this, everybody. It's not too late. The window of opportunity is closing every minute, every hour, every day, but the next 10 years are likely to be the most important in the next 10,000 years. We do have a chance. And I'd like to take you to a couple of the places that I think give us such a chance. I'd like to zoom off to the Galapagos Islands, a place that I first visited in 1966. I was among the first people ever to explore the islands underwater to see what Darwin never had a chance to see because he didn't have a mask, let alone flippers and a scuba tank or a submarine. But we live in this glorious sliver of time when we are empowered through new technologies, not only to go to places that we couldn't visit when I was a kid, and certainly not when Darwin was a kid, but to be able to see and then share the view and build that knowledge base, which is fundamental to caring. You can't care if you don't know. And the present moment that we live in is all about knowing, the power of communicating what already we have in the bank in terms of knowledge, and to go out there enthusiastically, vigorously, with hope that we can communicate what we know to develop that caring that will lead to action. It is basically what Goethe said many years ago about knowing, that it is not enough to know, you must also act. So let's go learn a little bit about the Galapagos Islands in this next little piece that will come up, I think, in a moment. And then I hope that the narration for this will be enough for our NPR audience. Oh, my goodness. Well, there we are. I will narrate. You can see the Galapagos
Islands. It's been
one
of the world's greatest trade routes for thousands of years. Its seabed still holds treasures of the Greek, Roman, and Egyptian empires that once
were in the Mediterranean, but that's all right.
Amphorae.
It's another treasured place. It's one of my hope spots. And not a problem. Just let it go. Be able to imagine that you're down there with Jacques Cousteau, as he was years ago.
Northwest of Sicily, the waters hold a bank of 8 shipwrecks, some dating back to the Roman Empire. Archaeologists are discovering relics, including intact glass cups polished to a cloudy transparency by the sea. As a young man, Jacques Cousteau fell in love with the Mediterranean Sea, diving among the coral reefs, finding creatures like the picky nudibranch that has a taste for only one species of sponge, the fireworm, whose white hairs can deliver a painful burn, and the green algae that turns silver when it dies. The creatures fascinated him, from the artfully camouflaged Scorpina rockfish to sea urchins with their voracious appetite for algae. These waters led Cousteau to develop the aqualung, which he said made it possible to hang, attached to nothing, a dream. I often had visions of flying by extending my arms as wings. Now I flew without wings. Another icon of the Mediterranean Sea is likely the fastest fish in the ocean, the bluefin tuna, called the cheetah of the sea. No human device can exceed the tuna's amazing propulsion efficiency, fueled by a diet of small fish. But even a racing bluefin cannot escape the hooks and nets of commercial fishing aimed at satisfying the global luxury market for tuna, seared, baked, broiled, and raw as sushi and sashimi. single 200-kilogram tuna may be shipped to Tokyo and sold for more than 100,000 U.S. dollars. The tunas are not alone among the sea's endangered species. The rarest and most endangered are the monk seals, which have been prized for their meat and fur, and also have been killed off by fishermen to eliminate them as competitors for fish. Today, there are fewer than 500 Mediterranean monk seals, and although they're officially protected, they may not survive. More than 500 million tons of sewage a year pour into the Mediterranean Sea, and the monk seals' homes have been displaced by human structures. Many die, tangled in fishing gear. Others are slaughtered illegally. As more people come to know about the ocean and take action to care for it, there's hope that the Mediterranean will be more than just a sea of legends.
So I'm going to hope that our wonderful modern technology will take us to the Arctic as the next hope spot. It should be number 2, and let's give it a shot. I see Arjun Gupta in the audience here. We were in the Arctic together just about this time last year with an Aspen Institute, National Geographic, and Lindblad expedition, and our mission was to really go to the place that is having such a profound impact on the climate of the world now and in the past and in the future. And what we are doing in terms of creating a rapid warming trend superimposed on the natural slow change that has taken place over the last 10,000 years since the end of the last ice age is causing an amazing shift in that part of the world. Let's go to the Arctic. And I think we're there.
Gleaming starkly white, the frozen Arctic Ocean crowns the top of the world above 66 degrees north latitude. In the Arctic, above the ice and below, wildlife prospers in what might seem to be an inhospitable environment. But it's exactly what is required for polar bears, ring seals, and the snowy white beluga whales, the highly vocal canaries of the sea. Narwhals, the legendary unicorns of the sea, and bowheads, the great ice whales, thrive there and nowhere else on Earth. In the cold, dark waters of the Arctic, life abounds as it has for millions of years, unknown, unseen, and still largely unexplored. Under the ice, and actually within the ice itself, life is surprisingly rich and diverse. Photosynthesizing organisms cast a green glow across the sweep of the ice. Arctic birds, fulmars, guillemots, kittiwakes, and ivory gulls survive on a diet rich in Arctic cod, while murres dive down as deep as 100 meters in search of fish and squid. Walruses look elsewhere for meals, using their great tusks to plow into the soft underwater terrain to extract clams, worms, and other tasty morsels. And deep within the heart of the Arctic, 4,200 meters down, is the North Pole, visited for the first time in August 2007 by 6 explorers in a pair of Russian submarines, Mir 1 and Mir 2. For hours, they observed and documented the seafloor, struggling to understand the nature of polar life far below the surface. The struggle to reach the North Pole at the Arctic's surface has lured hardy explorers for centuries. Robert Perry and Matthew Henson claimed the first successful expedition in 1909. Other explorers to the Arctic Ocean have sought the fabled Northwest Passage, a direct shipping route from Europe to Asia across the polar ice. Today, global warming is melting the ice cap so fast that scientists expect the passage to become a reliable summer shipping route within a few decades. That's good news for shipping, but bad news for polar bears, Arctic seals, and the people of the Arctic, whose cultural heritage is inextricably linked to living in a realm dominated by ice and snow. Keen interest is now focused on the Arctic and its nature, particularly because of the magnified importance of the frozen northern waters in shaping global climate and weather, the circulation of ocean currents, and ultimately, the well-being of humankind.
So there you are. I had a call in August of 2007 from Anatoly Sagalovich, who was the pilot and actually the chief designer of the subs, the Russian subs that went to the real North Pole. We had been talking, for 10 years about, wouldn't it be really a neat thing to do, to go to the real North Pole? Perry thought he got there, but that was just the top. The bottom of the ocean is where, if there is a real North Pole, that's where it is. And we had really looked at many strategies and got geared up several times, and every time it sort of came apart. Well, this call was on my cell phone. I missed the call, but I had this message. It started, it's something like this. He said, "Sylvia, this is Anatoly. I am calling you from the North Pole. I have just come back from 4,200 meters below the ice." And then there was this clinking of glasses and hoo-ha in the background. You knew that they were celebrating with lots and lots of vodka, well chilled. He said, "We missed you." And then more whooping and hollering. This was a great achievement for science. And then this little afterthought, but it was our achievement. I mean, they put a flag, right, staked a flag in the heart of the North Pole, in the heart of the Arctic, a titanium flag, of course, Russian flag, trying to establish a claim that Russia is trying to support, that beyond the 200-mile area that is claimed by most nations as their exclusive economic zone, they're trying to make a case that the continental shelf extends out as much as 350 miles. That is possible under the terms of the Law of the Sea Treaty, which Russia has signed. We have not. So we're not at the table. I mean, we have signed it. We haven't ratified it. Congress has been pretty stiff about that, even though it has been signed by the president, by Clinton. So it's more than 10 years ago. So maybe soon it will be. We will be at the table, I hope, to be able to participate fully in the deliberations about what happens to the Arctic. Now, I serve as a member of the commission, the Arctic Aspen Arctic Commission, and at the end of this month we'll be meeting in Ottawa with other members of the commission to see what we can do under the auspices of the Aspen Institute to try to influence policy. It's not obviously an empowered commission to take decisions, but as with many other important deliberations, it's knowing, and it's talking, it's conveying information that sometimes is even, that transcends laws, transcends the rules and regulations. When people know, then they can care, and then they can act. And that's what this conference is all about. This is what the Ideas Festival is about. It's why I'm so thrilled to be a part of the Aspen Institute and to have a chance along with the rest of you, to make a difference at this critical point in time. I think I'll end right there and open it up for questions. I think we have a few minutes. I'll start right here in the front row.
Okay. I was wondering if there is any aerial photography of the garbage patch that is twice the size of Texas. I see the animals a lot wrapped in plastic, but not the, I don't know, totality of it, which must be perfect.
In the pages of the Atlas of the Ocean that just got published with the National Geographic, there's a photograph that shows a little dish that is filled with more plastic than plankton. Sometimes it's like 5 to 1 little shreds of plastic, including nurdles, the tiny little bits of plastic that are produced that become plastic spoons, plastic plates, plastic cups, plastic shoes, plastic this, plastic that. It's the basic raw ingredient that is light, and it's those little guys love to travel. They get blown around in the wind. They escape from this place and that. And sometimes they outnumber the grains of sand on a beach. They're pervasive. They're everywhere. And they get scooped up by little guys. But they're not obvious from high in the sky. They are obvious. The big chunks are. You know, when the Air France plane went down, the first sighting of what they thought was debris from the crash was just an example of the kind of debris that we're throwing in the ocean. Big chunks of stuff we still put into the sea. Hard to retrieve once it's there. But beach cleanups are retrieving tons of stuff that we put into the ocean. We need, meanwhile, to stop it at the source. Diving out there, you can see in the water column the shreds of plastic, but from high above, it's not so obvious. You can see the floating big chunks, but you can't see the most insidious things, the little tiny pieces that get engulfed by little creatures that then get engulfed by somewhat larger creatures that engulf and so on up the food chain. One little fish, only about 4 inches long, was taken out in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It had 400 pieces of plastic in its tiny little belly. And again, this number 400 is haunting because a whale was washed up onshore, sperm whale, on the beach of California about a year ago that had 400 pounds of plastic in its gut. It's one of the big problems. Again, it's the Wardy Bliggins attitude. It doesn't matter what we do. So I'll survive for the next 10 or 20 years or 40 or 50 or whatever it is. It's not all about us. If you give a hoot about how you'll be remembered, how your kids will think of you, how you'll think of yourself 10 years from now. Why didn't I do something while there still was a chance? Let's go to the way back. Yellow hat.
How do you know the rivers and lakes fit into your world?
Rivers and lakes? Rivers and lakes, where do they fit into the world? They fit in totally connected. It's part of the circulatory system of the planet. Water is the key. Fresh water accounts for about 3% of Earth's water. 97% of the 3% is locked up in the Arctic and Antarctic ice, mostly in Antarctica. More and more of that, of course, is becoming ocean water as time passes, but that's why I say that the ocean is where it really counts in terms of water, because fresh water that goes up into the sky, into clouds that comes back to recharge rivers, lakes, and streams comes from the sea largely. Of course, it comes from the forests as well. We look out from where we are here in Aspen, you can see those puffy white clouds, and that water largely has evaporated from the land, but it's complemented and really overshadowed by the amount that comes from the sea and drives climate, weather, the water cycle, the carbon cycle, the nitrate cycle, the oxygen cycle. It's what keeps us alive. But certainly it's connected. And what happens upstream certainly affects what's downstream. I guess I'm focusing on what happens downstream and how it connects back to the upstream part. Yes?
The few degrees of global climate warming
has already destroyed significant areas of the coral reefs. That's a huge loss in itself, but it's not clear to me what the implications are for dying coral reefs for the oceans as a whole.
The question is about coral reefs and the increase in temperature that is having an impact on coral reefs around the world. Well, here's the thing. Yes, there is a correlation between the warming trend and what is known as coral bleaching and otherwise causing decline of coral reefs globally. In the last half century, since I was a kid, since I began diving, since you began diving, about half the coral reefs have either disappeared or they have undergone serious decline, and part of the reason is the warming trend. But here's the thing. If you bore down into the places where coral reefs have existed continuously for literally hundreds of thousands of years through ice ages that have come and gone when the climate has been warmer and cooler, the coral reefs have persisted because they were intact. The corollary to warming is that we've dismembered the integrity of those reefs. We've extracted the sharks, the groupers, the eels, the wildlife, the lobsters, so that you have a fragment of what makes a coral reef a coral reef. Corals are about the corals, just as New York is about the buildings. But it's also about the taxi drivers and even the lawyers count, believe it or not. And we have extracted systematically critical parts of what makes a coral reef healthy. So you've got a system that is not as resilient and able to recover from a warming trend. So that's part of the reason that we have seen the decline. Even independently of the warming trend, the reefs have been affected and afflicted and have declined owing to the loss of the fish, the lobsters, and the other critically important elements of what's there. Plus, what we're putting into the ocean and causing, in some cases, like around Hawaii, just the sedimentation. We've smothered the reefs through the upstream addition of a lot of stuff that simply covers up the little polyps that make the corals thrive. And the Great Barrier Reef is another sad story where agriculture along the shores have added huge quantities of nitrates which favor some organisms over others. And you get these great blooms of algae, which are important. We need to have them. But they overwhelm the reefs in cases and simply smother the reefs, not just with the sediment, but with the overabundance of certain kinds of algae. So it's complicated. It is about warming, but it's about all these other things that we're doing. Let's go over here, right there.
pH factor changing in the ocean.
Oh, yes. I sat on a panel with Representative Markey not long ago, about a year ago, actually. Jane Lubchenco, who's now the administrator of NOAA, was on the same panel. The topic was ocean acidification. I've been on other panels where people have been asked, so what's the biggest problem facing the ocean today? And you could say it's the overfishing, and I certainly think that is a big loss of wildlife, having seen a huge decline, destructive fishing generally. But the addition of carbon dioxide, over abundance of it now in the atmosphere, is causing this trend toward acidification that nobody suspected 10 years ago. Amazing. Things are happening so fast. Why worry about a trend toward acidification in the ocean? Because think of all the, not just corals, although corals have a calcium carbonate shell, structure, but the little guys that produce much of the oxygen that we rely on have a calcium carbonate shell too. You don't see their names on t-shirts yet, but maybe someday you'll see, have you thanked the coccolithophorid today? Because they do much of the heavy lifting in terms of generating oxygen. Another that doesn't have a calcium carbonate shell, but is certainly susceptible to changes in pH, are the creatures called Prochlorococcus. It's a blue-green bacteria that a scientist from MIT, Penny Chisholm, 25 years ago discovered for the first time on an oceanographic expedition looking at plankton in the ocean, but they were using a new technique. So they were able to find this microbeast that curiously is responsible for about one in every five breaths you take. in terms of the oxygen that's delivered. 20% of the oxygen in the atmosphere from Prochlorococcus alone that we didn't even know about 25 years ago. Now it's on the balance sheet, and now we should be thinking about the coccolithophorids, the Prochlorococcus, any of the creatures, the pteropods, little mollusks that have a susceptibility to a change in pH, that are the middlemen in translating the sun's energy through plants to these little yummy bits of protoplasm that small creatures like to feed upon. They can't graze directly on the phytoplankton, but they can graze on these swimming snails that will be done in with a significant change in pH. So why should we worry about that? Because our lives depend on it, that's why. And so the warming trend, sea level rise, the changes in climate as affects agriculture, affects our heating bills and cooling bill, all those things, of course it matters. But what's happening to the ocean should be right at the top of the list. Yes. You and then you.
Programmed to react to the snake that crosses the path in front of us, but not to these kinds of concerns, which between now and the time I get home, I'm not going to do anything about.
Why not? I'm sorry.
because it is illogical not to go after these things. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to be in human nature, and we've known about what's going on wrong with the Earth for a long time, and
and so the question is specifically,
how do you think you really can motivate people beyond knowledge? How do we get people to really move?
The question is about the inspiring people to react to something that seems a little bit out there. It's not you're immediately going to affect you with this next breath you're going to take. You suggested the snake in your path. Well, I love snakes. They're so cool. I would probably react favorably to seeing one, unless it was about to bite me and it was a cobra or something, which is the kind of threat you're talking about. So that is the real dilemma, how to get people to wake up and take action. People ask me sometimes, what can they do? And I have thought about it a lot, and I have said sometimes, well, you need to go look at the mirror and see who you are, what you can do. Look at the talents you have. Do you have a way with numbers, a way with words? Are you a mom, a dad, you have a kid, you can inspire? It seems like a long road, but you'd be surprised how fast kids grow up, and what you implant in their good minds now is going to really make a difference, or not, coming in the next few years. But the other thing, two important pieces of technology. The mirror is one, the other is a 2x4. It's what people use to wake up a stubborn mule, farmers, when they want to get their attention. We need to use a good, hefty 2x4 to first apply it to yourself. Say, look, this is urgent. This is not something to be put off for the next generation. That's what the last generation thought, and look at the fix we're in, how much we've lost as a consequence of complacency, of an unwillingness to take action when we knew there was a problem. Well, we didn't know with the urgency that we now know. We have a real problem. We don't have time to sit around and contemplate, well, shall we allow the mountaintop removal in West Virginia or not? No, we should just stop that cold because it is contributing so significantly to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Put the pressure on to move to alternative energy. Do it now, not 10 years from now, or even 5 or even 6 months from now. Do it now. What can you do before the day is over that can make a difference? Listen to Michael Pollan in terms of his looking at the food we eat, the big carbon footprint. If you go to the grocery store, I say, forget the wild fish. Forget the wildlife. And that's what most fish are that you see. But don't eat any tuna, for heaven's sakes. There's a huge carbon footprint with every tuna. And I don't mean just the transportation costs to get it from the other side of the world to where you are. Invested in every tuna is a huge trail of a food chain To make a pound of cow, it's about 20 pounds of plants. To make a pound of tuna, it's about 100,000 pounds of plants going through a long and twisted food chain. To make 1 pound of tuna fish, because they're top carnivores that eat other carnivores, that eat other carnivores. We don't eat carnivores that we raise because we don't raise carnivores. We go out and catch wild fish that are. So think about your food habits. Low on the food chain, locally raised. I mean, it's better for you, unless you really like all that mercury and fire retardant and PCBs and DDTs and all that stuff in you. Well, avoid these high carnivorous fish, and it's most of the fish that you'll see on most restaurant menus. It just is perverse. But now we know. You can change, and you can change the people around you. But don't wait. There isn't time. Yes?
Earth Day this year, I'm driving and listening to NPR, and this woman is describing, she said that there are still phosphates in your dishwasher, so in the electric machines, and that the P&G, Procter & Gamble, I thought we took this out. I thought we took this out in the 80s. There was legislation that took it out of our the liquid dishwasher soap. It took it out of the laundry soap. It didn't take it out of the soap that goes into your electric dishwasher. And I want you all today to go home and to check it out. The seventh generation, which is Tecumseh's wonderful quote, be careful what you do. It may affect seven generations. You said Chief Tecumseh said that. And there's a product called Seventh Generation. The role of phosphates. This woman was talking about the bloom of algae down the Mississippi River. Now, I think some of it comes from farms, right? What is phosphate exactly? I mean, we can stop using, you know, checking out, although I couldn't buy it locally, by the way. I couldn't find it in Snowmass, the proper, right kind of phosphate-free, dishwasher soap for my, for my electric machine, dishwasher machine. But the role of phosphates.
Now the question is about the role of phosphates that we are putting into the sea, right up there with the nitrates and all the other load of materials that we're allowing to flow perversely into the sea. I mean, it starts in every household. You think if you live in Iowa that it doesn't matter, but Iowa connects to the Mississippi that connects to the ocean. And you think wherever you are, what we put on the down our drains, what we put on our golf courses, what we put on our fields and farms, whatever it is, it connects. I think the real key, the real solution is what the Aspen Institute is all about, which is knowing. Because if you don't know, you can't care. If you don't care, you won't act. There are alternatives. It's up to us. You think somebody's going to take care of us. You think that if you don't see a product, if you do see a product in the grocery store or on a menu, thinking about the fish again that we consume, it's got to be all right. Somebody's looking out for us. The one who has to look out for us is us, you, every individual, every consumer. And that is the power that we need to exert to turn things around. We have an opportunity to change things through what we're putting into the atmosphere above, through what we're putting down the drain. It's good for our individual everyday lives to choose based on knowing the best choices and then following through and believing that we now that the knowledge is there with computers, with libraries, with conferences such as this Aspen Ideas Conference. If you've been here and listened to any of this and you haven't left with your head sort of throbbing, you haven't been listening. So I'm really pleased with the question and the other questions that are here. Here's one more here.
What would the result be in the long term if we ate the plankton and the algae and not the little guys?
I'm sorry?
If we consume the algae and the green matter rather than the guys swimming around.
The question is, what if we consumed the algae? The little guys start at the real bottom of the food chain. Well, some people actually are doing that. You can get these nice, healthy really dark blue-green green drinks that not everybody who loves a good thick steak would agree that this is a desirable way to go, but maybe that we can certainly dial it down, eat low on the food chain, and I do believe that going forward we will mine the microbes much more effectively than we have to date. And if we are going to have fuels that are biofuels, that growing things that in contained vats that turn over very quickly, as they do in the ocean, has a really good chance of being a positive alternative. The bacteria, for heaven's sakes, the microbes, they rule the world right now. We just need to tap into their power. And for food, absolutely. It's where most of the food on the planet comes from now, because that's what drives the great ocean food webs. Whales dial in to tune into it by eating krill or small fish that in turn feed on tiny plankton that in turn feed on the little tiny guys. But whales cannot extract the microbes. They rely on the middlemen along the way. One of the critically important creatures in this respect is called menhaden. And if you don't know menhaden, read the little book called The Most Important Fish in the Sea. It's by Bruce Franklin, and it talks about menhaden. When you get fish oil and those nice little capsules to improve your health, you're just undermining the health of the ocean, because they kill menhaden to squeeze out the oil to give to you. And the menhaden are really critically important because they feed at the bottom of the food chain. They actually can tap into the little green guys and the little blue-green guys. And then the bigger fish and other creatures, the dolphins and whales, eat them. They are among the most important, in the Atlantic at least, important middlemen that there are. And it's just wrong to take them for fertilizer, to take them for fish meal, to take them for omega-3 capsules, when there are plant alternatives, either by looking at walnuts and the other many sources of omega-3s that don't have mercury and fire retardants and all those other things you don't want that are in the fish that come back to you. But also, there are companies that are engaged in raising the plankton to get a straight shot of the DHA, omega-3, long-chain fatty acids that are so good for us. We don't have to kill fish to get them. Martek is a company that produces them, for example, and it's great. I mean, it's primarily, initially for pregnant moms, but it's good for anybody. It's good for everybody, but we shouldn't kill the fish. They're much more important in the ocean than they are, you know, swimming in us.
Thank you, Sylvia, for all that you do.
Thank you. Thank you.